the shape of the Trump administration's America First policy in business, diplomacy, and technology. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, March 13th, and we're glad you could be with us today. There are reports this afternoon that the Trump administration may be looking to impose tariffs on Chinese goods. Numbers vary from $30 billion to, as Reuters suggested, as much as $60 billion in tariffs that would target tech products and telecom companies. That decision would, of course, follow new tariffs on steel and aluminum and President Trump's surprise move this week to block Singapore-based Broadcom's bid to buy Qualcomm, both semiconductor companies. He was backed by a recommendation from the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which reviews foreign deals with possible national security implications. Semiconductor deals often get extra scrutiny since the tech is so important. But Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains this case is a little different.
Back in November, President Trump actually called Broadcom one of the really great, great companies.
We're thrilled to welcome Broadcom Limited and its CEO, Hock Tan, to the White House.
He was celebrating the company's decision to relocate to the U.S. John Cabillo is a lawyer who specializes in national security cases like this one.
So in the span of 5 months, they went from being welcomed with open arms back to the U.S. to being, you know, labeled as part of a national security threat. It's really an extraordinary turn of events.
So that's the first thing that's a little unusual about this case. The buyer is about to be an American firm. The second is how national security comes into play. The Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS, is actually worried this deal will make Qualcomm less competitive, particularly if Broadcom cuts its high investment in R&D. Angela Zeno, an equity analyst at CFRA who covers both companies, said Qualcomm is poised to be a big player in future 5G mobile networks.
The last thing they wanted to see was Broadcom acquire Qualcomm and break the company up into pieces and have an inferior Qualcomm, whereas it would be much more difficult for the U.S. to advance next-generation technology.
Weaker Qualcomm leaves more room for a Chinese firm to take the lead on 5G. Daniel Rosen is with the Rhodium Group.
Even if this had been a French or a German firm trying to take over Qualcomm, there would probably be strong U.S. misgivings.
And he thinks other countries would have blocked this deal as well. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
As you've almost certainly heard by now, President Trump also fired his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. The State Department will face some tough challenges globally in the months ahead, everything from North Korea's nuclear program to the nuclear deal with Iran. But the new Secretary of State will have to deal with more than just diplomacy. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports from Washington on the economic role the State Department plays.
A big part of the job for the nation's top diplomat is economic diplomacy.
The State Department is responsible for taking the lead in negotiating all kinds of international agreements we have with our trading partners and our allies.
Matthew Connolly is a history professor at Columbia University. He studies how the work of diplomats abroad affects businesses in the U.S.
They're often in the role of finding investors in American companies, finding markets for American companies. And there are hundreds of these commercial officers all deployed at hundreds of embassies all over the world.
There's also a more punitive economic role for the agency, says Barbara Linney.
Well, the State Department plays an important role in the context of U.S. economic sanctions.
Linney is a partner at the Miller and Chevalier law firm, which focuses on international trade. She says the State Department plays a big role in tracking how non-Americans deal with sanctioned countries.
Most of the sanctions lifted by the United States under the Iran nuclear deal were secondary sanctions administered by the State Department.
But there are fewer people doing that work under the Trump administration. Several key positions are empty, awaiting nominees or Senate confirmations. Max Steyer tracks such vacancies at the Partnership for Public Service.
We have missing positions that are more explicitly focused on economic issues. The Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and Environment also has no nominee. But in large measure, there are big gaps across the board.
Steyer says the new Secretary of State will also inherit a shrinking staff of career diplomats plus low agency morale. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, tech investors were absolutely fine with the called-off Qualcomm merger. The details on that and more when we do the numbers. Amid all the news from the White House today, President Trump was in California to check in on prototypes for the wall he wants built between Mexico and the United States. Most of the discussion of immigration refers to people coming to this country. But as tensions between Mexico and the U.S. increase, it's catching people leaving here as well. More than 250,000 people who were born in the U.S. to Mexican parents now live in Mexico but haven't been registered in either country. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia files this story.
I'm standing in Mexico City's equivalent of the DMV. It's crowded, it's stuffy.
Siga formada, señora.
There's a guy whose job it is to keep people standing in line. And figuratively, Daniela Silva Bascal has been stuck here for years.
Silva, my name is Daniela Silva Bascal.
Silva Bascal was born in the mid-90s when her parents briefly lived and worked in the U.S.
And where were you born?
Phoenix, Arizona.
Shortly after, Silva Vasquez's parents left Phoenix for their native state of Puebla in central Mexico.
I'm from Mexico. Es que ya me siento de aquí.
Silva Vasquez says she feels Mexican. Her lawyer says she's an American and a Mexican citizen. But even though she's lived in Mexico virtually her entire life, she doesn't have enough documentation to prove she can legally work, pay taxes, or vote here. She says she found out when she was applying for admission to a public university.
Ahí aparece como documento migratorio el mío. Entonces, ahí fue cuando cambió todo.
That's when everything changed, she says. Her application as an international student would cost more than 30 times what her classmates paid, all because her parents didn't have sufficient documentation from Arizona to register her before Mexican authorities.
So this is a really complicated and common problem.
Jillian Wagman is an attorney with the Institute for Women in Migration, a nonprofit in Mexico City. According to Mexican government figures, more than 280,000 children live in Mexico in a situation similar to Silva Bascal's. The challenges for parents of American-born children include proving the birth certificate is legitimate. For that, you need an official seal called an apostille.
It is a word in English. You can get an apostille in the United States. The entity that issued the document issues apostilles.
The easiest way to get the seal is for the parent to get it in person, if the parent is still in the U.S.
If the family doesn't have a copy of the
child's birth certificate, it takes Wagman a while to explain the 10-step process to transfer someone's identity.
Then see what the birth certificate says, if it has an error.
I'm really sorry. I think, like, my mind just, like, went numb. I was trying to follow really hard. But
it's really complicated.
Wagman says this would be more manageable if local American governments made children's documents more accessible to parents, or if Mexican authorities were more flexible. Claudia Luengas Escudero oversees Mexico City's Civil Registry Office.
Es una guerra al subregistro.
Luenga says registering adult Mexican citizens is an ongoing battle. The most recent estimate says that in the city alone, more than 1.5 million people never got a birth certificate. There are many reasons why so many people born in Mexico are unregistered. In some families, no one has ever gotten documented. In other cases, the father has refused to accept paternity. So the foreign-born children of Mexican parents are not a priority for local authorities. That includes people like Daniela Silva Bascal.
Estado de Arizona, Departamento del Estado.
Silva Bascal is reading out a special apostille seal from the Arizona Secretary of State, legitimizing her birth certificate. Her family was able to get it only recently through the help of a Mexican-American lawyer who took up their case for free.
Pero lo importante era esto, nada más.
Silva Bascal may now be able to prove her Mexican citizenship. Her priorities are going to school and voting. As for traveling to the U.S., she says that maybe someday visiting the Grand Canyon would be nice. In Puebla, Mexico, I'm Jorge Valencia for Marketplace.
A little more now on the sometimes unnoticed voices that are part of the stories we explore here at Marketplace. There is a new episode today of a podcast called Make Me Smart that I host with Kai Rizdahl, you know, your usual guy. We've been on a little break, but we're back with regular episodes. And our guest on today's episode is Ai-Jen Poo. She's the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And recently, she showed up on the red carpet as Meryl Streep's guest at the Golden Globes. It was part of a high-profile attempt to highlight the Me Too and Time's Up movement, and Ai-Jen Poo's attempt to raise attention and money for workers who play a critical role in the economy, but who often get overlooked.
Well, so I represent this workforce that goes to work in our homes every day, caring for our children as nannies, caring for our aging parents and grandparents as home care workers, home health aides, and cleaning our homes as house cleaners. And it's we call it the work that makes all other work possible, because it makes it possible for us to go and do what we do every day, knowing that some of the most important aspects of our lives are in good hands. And yet it's some of the most undervalued and invisible work in our economy. And if you think about it, it's like you could go into any neighborhood and not know which homes are also workplaces, right? They're not registered anywhere. It's not like there's a list where you could, you know, identify. And then it's also this situation where, you know, there's no water cooler, there's no lunch room, there are no coworkers, there's no HR department, certainly. And it's incredibly isolating too. So domestic workers, you know, it's a little bit unpredictable, because you might have a wonderful family who you stay with for years and sometimes generations. And then there's also human trafficking, modern-day slavery-type cases, rape and sexual assault, and everything in between.
You know, we talk a lot on this show about how the economy doesn't always work for everyone, and the power imbalance fundamentally is what allows this behavior to go on. You know, interestingly, I was just having makeup done for a video shoot at Marketplace and was talking to a makeup artist who said that throughout Hollywood, there are all of these independent women who do makeup and who have no protection and who get sexually harassed on the job all the time. And even if they're in unions, they're showing up at hotel rooms at 5 a.m. to do makeup. You know, what can be done to kind of address these structural power imbalances, and to even maybe look, get Hollywood actresses to say, hey, talk to the person who's doing your makeup in a trailer?
I mean, one of the things about our protections for workers, for working people, is that they emerged in the context of a fundamentally different economy. When we put our labor laws in place, it was a manufacturing-based economy and a nationally-based economy. We now have a globalized world, and we're in the middle of the fourth industrial revolution, where technology is changing everything. And we're just, we have not updated our policy frameworks for how we protect workers for several generations. And so there are major gaps in terms of who is protected and how they're protected. And I represent a workforce that was actually left out of the original protections. So we've been operating in this context of lawlessness for generations. And that's why I think it's women like the makeup artists, who are independent contractors who have also been left out, and workers like domestic workers, who need to be shaping the protections for the future.
How do you keep your eye on the long view ball when the needs are so instant right now? I mean, as you just said, the people you represent are not currently legally protectable, right?
That's right. There are major loopholes that millions of women are falling through the cracks of our protections at this moment. I would say, though, that every single employer has a responsibility and an opportunity to look at their own internal policies. There's nothing stopping individual organizations and companies from strengthening their sexual harassment policies today, right? And so that has to be a part of the culture and norm change in our economy.
That's Ai-Jen Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Subscribe to the Make Me Smart podcast and get caught up. There are new episodes coming every week. Coming up.
You can't scream at 3 a.m. when there are two children who are actually sleeping as well as a husband. But I channeled my frustration into Google.
Frustration, emojis, and a whole new world of advertising. But first, let's do the numbers. Another down day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 0.6%, 171 points to close at 25,000.007. The NASDAQ fell 1%, 77 points to finish at 7511. And the S&P 500 shed 0.6%, 17 points, ending at 2765. Shares of telecommunications product maker Qualcomm, which we told you about earlier, slumped 4.9% today. Singapore-based Broadcom Limited fell 0.6%. Verizon dialed down 0.3%. Amazon opened its first Washington, D.C. bookstore today in a prestigious Georgetown location that used to be a Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble down 2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
You go first this time.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood.
And I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Our podcast, Make Me Smart, is back, and we are exploring something you need to succeed in business, politics, you know, basically everywhere.
It is the art, the lost art, some might say, of compromise.
Yeah, because this country is not going to get where it needs to go. Frankly, you and your boss are not going to get where you need to go if you cannot even get people in the room.
We're not doing the room.
The
where
room
it
where not, it happens.
We're not.
How come we can't? Can we just compromise on this one issue?
No.
Just singling a little bit?
No. Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. And I know we're all having a lot of complicated feelings about a lot of things these days. Thankfully, there are emojis to help us communicate our thoughts in the modern age. And over 150 new emojis are coming to phones later this year, like a female superhero, a mosquito, a lobster. You can just feel your vocabulary expanding. Also expanding, the ability of advertisers to track your lobster tastes. Marketplace's Peter Ballin and Rosen has that story.
For Flory Hutchinson, the creator of a new ballet flat emoji, it all began with a trip to the grocery store. There, two of her daughters, ages 4 and 5, grabbed a Disney book called Polite as a Princess.
I took a picture of the book, I put it on Instagram, I tagged Disney and said would love to see Polite as a Prince.
She thought if they're going to tell girls how to act, they should tell boys too. She then headed with her two daughters, plus her 6-month-old, to buy a new stroller.
As I scanned them all, I realized that out of the 25-plus options of baby carriers, there was only one on which the packaging featured a dad.
Again, more gender roles. That night, she woke up to breastfeed her 6-month-old and started a text to her sister.
The emoji that auto-populated for the word shoe was a red high-heeled stiletto.
A fire engine red stiletto. She looked through the emoji keyboard. All the women's shoes had heels, and everything from the day flooded back.
You can't scream at 3 a.m. when there are two children who are actually sleeping as well as a husband. But I channeled my frustration into Google.
And she learned emojis are crowdsourced. Anyone can submit an idea to Unicode, the group behind emojis. So she sent an email saying,
I'd like to propose a flat shoe alternative.
Over the next month, Hutchinson whipped up a proposal for a small blue ballet flat. A few months later, Unicode announced the new emojis.
And there in the mix of 150-plus emoji is my little blue ballerina flat. And I literally died.
As emoji grows, how we communicate grows. And you best believe someone's trying to make a buck off of that.
If somebody tweets using an emoji, that can be a factor in which you can target your ads.
Aaron Goldman is chief marketing officer at 4C Insights. They're one of 6 companies that offers emoji-targeted Twitter ads, basically sending you ads based on the emojis you tweet.
If someone puts a thumbs up or a smiley face, then show them this ad. If they do a frowny face or a thumbs down, show them a different ad.
Twitter has sold data about people's emoji use to advertisers since 2016.
You know, we've seen people targeting football and basketball emojis for, you know, athletic wear.
Goldman says a Twitter ad for a fast food company got almost three times as many likes, retweets, and comments when they targeted people based on their emojis. And that may come down to the emotion part of emoji. TJ Hughes is strategic account manager at AdParlor.
Advertisers don't want to sell you something if you don't want it, right? It wastes our dollars and it wastes your time. So if we can make advertising relevant, that's the beauty of it.
Data like age and gender give advertisers info about you. Emojis get in your head. Last fall, Toyota ran an ad campaign to match people's moods based on their emoji use. They took 83 different emojis and made 83 different videos, then sent the ads out accordingly. Jamie Court, president of the nonprofit Consumer Watchdog, is super not into this.
When companies start to create a psychological profile of people based on their emotions and then advertise them based on that profile, that's intrusive. People are not used to tweeting an emoji for a piece of pizza and then getting an ad for a weight loss center or for Weight Watchers.
Not that that's happened yet. When 157 new emojis hit keyboards later this year, there'll be 157 more things to track, like Flory Hutchinson's little blue ballet flat.
That's kind of creepy. But I think technology is going that way.
She says if someone tweets her shoe, they might now at least get ads for realistic footwear. From New York, I'm Peter Ballinon-Rosen for Marketplace.
In addition to tracking your every emoji for advertising purposes, big tech companies are also dabbling in big finance, and banks are starting to notice. You may know that Google and Apple and other tech companies do mobile payments. You may not know that Amazon has loaned over $1 billion to small businesses, and Apple owns more corporate debt than some of the world's biggest bond funds. Lionel Laurent wrote about this for Bloomberg's Gadfly section. We called him up to talk about big tech creeping into the highly regulated world of big banking. Lionel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So what kinds of things are tech companies doing that encroach into the financial sector?
So I think we're all familiar with the fact that small, they call them fintech startups, have been trying to nibble away at the territory held by banks. So we know about marketplace lending, websites where you can get a loan, consumer finance apps, they're all out there. But what's interesting is how the really big tech companies, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Amazons, have been slowly, much more conservatively tiptoeing into that area. So they're all active, but I think what everyone's really asking themselves is, when do the really big tech companies make a really big play for financial services? That has not happened yet.
And what do you think that might look like?
You know, my view is that these companies know they do have a lot to lose if they go too aggressively, if they try and disrupt banking the way they disrupted retail, bookstores, media. I think if they go too quickly, then they risk getting regulators and politicians on their case, saying, are these companies too big and too powerful? So I think it's going to be a bit slower than people think.
So you're saying if they move too aggressively, then they would have to apply for some sort of traditional banking license, or that regulators might just crack down and say, OK, you're a bank now?
Exactly. And I think that it's this kind of strategic approach that they're not used to, right? I think it's a bit like the image of a kind of, you know, invading a castle or a fort. They've gone for the easy to disrupt or the least regulated businesses in the world, you know, and they've done a very ferocious job of essentially tearing the rug out from old established businesses that were not protected by big regulatory moats. And now we're getting to the hard part of the corporate landscape. These big tech companies, they've had a great decade, but they still need to grow. And as they try and dip into new business areas, then yes, regulators will start to ask the question, you know, hold on, should we allow these big tech companies to become banks? This is an era when everyone is looking at tech companies in a different way, as big tech instead of Silicon Valley. And I think they know that if they go into banking too frontally, that's only going to get worse.
So then, you know, for consumers, we're left with Amazon and Google and Apple. even tiptoeing around the edges, still dealing with a lot of money, whether it's in terms of lending or consumer payments, but they don't have banking licenses. So, you know, what's at stake for the public? Should consumers be concerned about unregulated pseudo banking?
I don't think so yet. I think there's a few differences here. I think that one of the reasons why big tech companies are doing finance-like activities is because they just have too much money. And it's not money that is similar to banking money, which is banks get money from, yes, us, the public, depositors, but they also get money from lending markets. This is cash that they have because their core products are phenomenally successful. And that basically means that it's just less risky money. Yes, there might be some problems, but I think right now, regulators are not looking at this and thinking, whoa, this is just like a bank. I mean, this is not like having Lehman Brothers in Silicon Valley. Not yet.
Lionel Laurent writes about finance, markets, and business for Bloomberg's commentary section. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
And this final note before we go, after getting caught up in scandal and paying billions of dollars in fines for cheating on diesel emissions testing, Volkswagen is making a hard pivot to electric. The company announced today that it's investing $25 billion in electric car batteries. It plans to build 16 electric vehicle plants by 2022 and says it'll launch 30 EVs by 2025. For some context here, the second biggest buyer of electric car batteries is Tesla. It's spending $17 billion. Tesla stock was down about a point today. All right, we got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 0.6%, about 171 points. The NASDAQ fell 1%, 77 points. The S&P 500 down 0.6%, or 17 points. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I am Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a great night. Kai's back in tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.